Thanks for listening on Friday, November 6, 2015. It is the Federal News Countdown, the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, I'm selling you short. It's one expert and one numbskull. Bob Tobias of American University, former head of the National Treasury Employees Union, is the expert. It's great to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning, Francis.
And last time you were here, we had a cancellation, and I enjoyed it so much just doing it one-on-one with you that that's how we're going to do it again today.
Well, thank you.
I've chosen three stories, and we're going to talk about those. And you've made three great selections, and you can follow along with the stories on federalnewsradio.com. And we'll start where we always do with...
Number three!
Bob, your choice at number three is from GovExec. The headline is, Fighting Back Against the Conference Spending Crackdown. This started, this dialogue within government, with an op-ed by Sandra Magnus, who's executive director of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, who also happens to be a former space shuttle astronaut. And she was talking about the problems that the conference crackdown generated by the GSA scandal is causing, especially in the scientific community, because there are a whole lot of people outside the government in the scientific community that want to collaborate with and learn from government scientists, and they're not able to anymore.
And they are not able to anymore. That says it all, Francis. Collaboration is what generates new, innovative, creative ideas. And when people can't get together, they can't talk, they can't exchange those ideas, we don't maximize the knowledge leverage that we have.
The op-ed in the Washington Post by Ms. Magnus cited a March Government Accountability Office report showing that would-be Energy and Defense Department federal participants in conferences have to wait months to receive approval to participate. And then when they do get the thumbs up, it happens just a couple of days in advance. I imagine that makes the expenses greater. It's harder to get a decent airfare a couple of days ahead of time compared to a couple of months. Do you have any sense that there is a tide turning, or is this just kind of a critical mass right now of people saying, hey, I'm losing out on opportunities to be able to do my job better?
It's not just the scientific community. It's the agency who need to get managers together over time to talk about solving problems. It's having managers travel to talk to employees in different locations. All of these opportunities to meet face-to-face and one-on-one have been significantly reduced over time, and I believe the kind of connection, the kind of engagement that's needed to maximize productivity.
The other wrinkle here, and as somebody who moderates a lot of events around town and so on, I've seen this happen. When you don't get approvals till just a couple of days ahead of time, there's no way the promoter of an event or the host of an event can count on you as a speaker. And so government agencies are losing out on opportunities for their people to take speaking roles and really highlight front and center before audiences of influence exactly the work that those agencies are doing.
No question about it. Absolutely no question about it. I mean, the process is laborious for a reason. Mm-hmm. It's laborious to discourage the kind of travel that I believe is critical to engagement. Now, obviously, what happened with the GSA scandal, and it was a scandal, is important, but it's not the way that agencies have behaved across the government. But Congress leveraged that scandal to reduce the kind of activity that I think that's critical to agency success.
Are we still too close, though, do you think, to the GSA scandal for agencies to be able to try to do something about this on their own without incurring the wrath of whoever their overseers in Congress happen to be?
I think it's time for agencies to take a stand and say, we need this. We are monitoring it. We're guaranteeing that there aren't going to be people, pictures appearing in bathtubs holding glasses of champagne on Facebook again.
Bob Tobias's choice is the third most important federal news story of the week. It's from GovExec, Fighting Back Against the Conference Spending Crackdown. My choice at number three is my colleague Nicola Grisco's story on federalnewsradio.com. OPM shifts focus in monthly retirement reports. Now, there's two ways to look at this. There's the practical utilitarian way to look at it, which I'll explain in a moment. And there is the cynical way to look at this, Bob. The practical utilitarian way to look at this is the way that Ken Zawadny, the Associate Director of Retirement Services at OPM, presented this when Nicole did this reporting. And that is, he said, to more accurately reflect the kind of information federal employees and retirees will need to make decisions about their retirement. This is a quote from Mr. Zawadny. The information that makes a difference to them for decision purposes is, how long does it take to process my retirement? How long till I get my final retirement check, meaning the correct amount that you're going to receive? Those are really the numbers that folks are interested in. What they're getting away from is the projected number of claims that they'll receive, the amount that they've processed, and what the total number of the backlog is. And the cynical way, I think, of looking at this change is those numbers aren't very good. They haven't been good for a while. They don't appear to be making much progress. And by making those numbers go away, or at least de-emphasizing them, they're taking attention off of those numbers that don't seem to be improving very much.
I think that's right, Francis. On the one hand, the backlog and the number of cases are relevant to how effectively the program is being managed. If you want to evaluate it from the in that context, those are the numbers that need to be published. From the perspective of the consumer, but the consumer doesn't care about what the backlog is. The consumer cares about, when am I going to get my check? So my suggestion is that both would be published. Mm-hmm. This is not an either or. The data is readily available. Both should be published.
The agency, Nicole writes, will no longer report the projected number of claims it expects to receive and process, or the predicted size of its backlog, which is rather ironic, I think, because she writes in the story that they have a success story to tell in that area, at least for the month of October. The backlog stands at 12,642 claims in October, compared with 14,706 in September. October's inventory is the lowest it's been since December 2014. So that's progress at the time where they're not going to talk about their progress anymore.
The irony is, of course, that all of this information is available under a Freedom of Information Act. And if filed, OPM will provide the data. So why not provide the data?
Well, yeah, because you know somebody's going to file that request and ask for that information. You're going to have to wind up coming across with it at some point.
Absolutely.
Third most important federal news story of the week, as I've selected, is from federalnewsradio.com. OPM shifts focus in monthly retirement reports, and that story's on federalnewsradio.com. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week on this week's Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected this week by myself and Bob Tobias, and we're up to
number two.
And Bob, your choice at number two is from the Hill newspaper. The headline is "Ryan and Obama Vie for Upper Hand." And I have to say, this is a lot more confrontational portrayal of the situation that we're in with fixing the continuing resolution problem and getting an omnibus bill for the rest of fiscal 2016 than I've seen anyplace else. I'm not contesting the facts of the article. I'm just saying a lot of the coverage that I've seen of what's going on so far has been a lot more collegial and conciliatory than the way this piece is laying it out there.
It is. But at root, Francis, is whether or not the actual omnibus bill will be enacted. And if not, will there be the threat and the actuality of another shutdown? Federal employees and the public are exhausted by this constant threat of a shutdown. I mean, the most de-energizing factor in the workplace is uncertainty. And the uncertainty associated with shutdowns has been continuing now for 3 or 4 months. Enough. Get it done.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is most encouraging about the ascension of Paul Ryan to the speakership is people made a lot about, well, he's making this list of demands and all of that, and people kind of attached to maybe a little bit of a prima donna type approach to what he was saying to the members of his caucus, I looked at that a little differently. I looked at it as though he really could take it or leave it. He had the job he wanted, which was Ways and Means Committee chairman, and he was essentially saying, listen, if you don't, this is what I'm going to need to do this job well. These are the conditions under which I will need to operate. And if you guys don't want to do that, that's fine. I'm cool with that. But then you want somebody else to do the job. And one of the things that he said in this story that I think was particularly useful was on CNN's State of the Union, and this is about the Planned Parenthood situation. I think we need to be very clear about what it is we can and can't achieve, and not set expectations that we know we can't reach given the constraints of the Constitution. And what he's referring to there is President Obama still has veto power over anything that Congress sends him. So it doesn't matter. There could be up to 66 Republicans in the Senate, which there aren't, and there could be up to three quarters of the House to override a veto, be Republicans, which they aren't. Before they would be able to just ram anything down the president's throat. They can't do that. So it is, as he says, ridiculous to go to the mat for this stuff that's going to wind up never happening anyway. And it sounds like he gets that, at least.
I think he does, but so did Speaker Boehner. He got it as well. But in the crunch, he was unwilling to take a bill to the floor of the House and depend on Democrats to help him pass it when he had a minority of the Republican caucus in favor. Now, that's going to be the crunch point, it seems to me, for Speaker Ryan. How willing is he to enact legislation that may be opposed by a majority of his caucus?
So the nuts and bolts of this, Bloomberg reporting today that negotiations will continue next week on this, through even though the House and Senate aren't in session because of the Veterans Day holiday. I personally, as an outside observer, I find that really good news because it appears, Bob, they're trying not to wait until, I mean, historically what we've seen the last couple of years is if December 11th is the deadline, as it is, these negotiations usually start around December 4th, a week or so before, and we wind up with a bill on the floor of the House the evening of December 10th, and the Senate takes it up December 11th, and at midnight, the president signs it. And it looks like they're at least trying to avoid that this time around.
I have my fingers and toes crossed, Francis. It's the discussion, what if, what if, that bothers me.
How do you cross the toes exactly? I guess, well, maybe I don't want to know. Bob Tobias's choice is the second most important federal news story of the week. It's from the Hill newspaper. Ryan and Obama vie for upper hand. My choice at number two is from federalnewsradio.com. Congress seeks deal to discipline VA employees. Jeff Miller, the chairman of the House Veterans Affairs Committee, is at the Brookings Institution this week, along with Tim Walz, a Democratic member of the Veterans Affairs Committee. And the evolution of Chairman Miller's legislation has struck me as very, very curious. So the first bill that he passed was regarding disciplining SES members at the Department of Veterans Affairs. You and others talked about the fact that you expected this was not going to just stop with SES members at VA, and indeed you were correct. This year's legislation was regarding other employees at VA. And now the next step is happening here, and that's why I chose this story this week, that Jeff Miller is saying it's not just VA. These problems are happening at other agencies, and other agencies need tools to be able to discipline people more quickly. It's the slippery slope. If we regard this as a negative, it's the slippery slope that people have talked about when the first piece of legislation came out last spring. If this isn't necessarily a bad thing, and if hiring managers and leaders in government do need more tools and better resources to be able to move out people that are poor performers, then maybe this overall isn't such a bad thing, Bob. Where do you come down on this?
Well, I think it is a bad thing. I think the statute as it stands allows people to be discharged rather easily. The statutory standard for poor performers is easy to reach. The failure to meet the performance standard in one critical element is the basis for discharge on substantial evidence after a 60-day opportunity to improve that performance. That's an easy, easy standard to meet. And if you look over the last 5 years, people who've appealed their discharges on performance to the Merit Systems Protection Board have never been sustained substantively. Procedurally, yes, but never substantively. So the performance standard is easy to meet. The conduct standard is a little more difficult, preponderance of the evidence, but still easy to meet. The issue has been whether or not the infrastructure supporting a decision to discharge in an agency, a high-level management officials, lawyers, and so forth, are willing to support supervisors who initiate these charges. So I don't believe it's making it easier will solve a problem for poor performers or conduct. And the idea that Mr. Miller would say, where I come from, when you're fired, you're fired, you walk out the door that day, I think is a slight mistake. There are always lawsuits. There are, in places, arbitrations. So just because I say you're fired doesn't mean that that's going to be sustained and somebody isn't going to come back. And in the federal government, there is something called due process that requires notice and an opportunity to respond before any action is taken. So I think Mr. Miller's statement is hyperbole, and taking care of the conduct matters is something that can be done, should be done, and agency leaders should be responsible for making it happen.
Hyperbole from a politician. That never happens in this city. Bob, we see that so seldom. On a serious note, I mentioned Tim Walz, the a Democratic member of the House Veterans Affairs Committee that was at this Brookings Institution event that Emily Kopp reports about on federalnewsradio.com. He says VA already has the tools to get rid of bad actors, but administrators don't use them. And he explained the particular case at the hearing that the House Veterans Affairs Committee had on Monday evening about people who moved people out of jobs that they wanted, took those jobs, and then received big bonuses to move to those locations. He says the overall purpose of the legislation is sound, shouldn't be taken as an attempt to weaken labor unions within the federal government, although it'll be characterized that way. But he said, I would make the case that the acting undersecretary for benefits could have done his job better and not given bonuses to an underperforming employee and moved them somewhere else under the guise that he couldn't do anything about it. I mean, he's essentially making your case, which is use the tools that you've got and really use them effectively.
This isn't about a union issue. This is about whether or not federal employees have due process rights in the context of a highly politicized environment.
The second most important federal news story of the week, according to me, is from Emily Kopp. Congress seeks deal to discipline VA employees. And that story and all of our stories in this week's countdown are on federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week. We're back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. The Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week. This week, it's me and Bob Tobias choosing the stories, and we're up to
number one.
And Bob, your choice is the most important federal news story of the week is really a good news story. It's from GovExec. White House announces inaugural participants in program to develop new federal leaders. The story says 16 federal supervisors, currently GS-15s from agencies throughout government, will participate in the program in which managers will spend a year making stops across government to tackle cross-agency projects. So that's one sentence, and there's so much in there to like, Bob.
I agree. This is something that's been a year getting off the ground. It's off the ground now. They took a lot of time to select competitively select this group of people who are now going to be creating contacts across the government and working on problems that cross agency boundaries. And I think it's an excellent program and an something that's long been needed to develop people who can work across agencies and departments.
And I want to give President Obama and the White House particular credit in this. President Obama announced this originally in the speech that he gave to the senior executive service, about 3,000 SES people, about a year ago. And I wrote a commentary shortly after that speech, first of all, saying what took so long. And second of all, saying, okay, great, you can talk now that you're 6.5 or so years, almost 7 years into your tenure. Now let's see what you've got. Well, he's got something pretty good. And I continue to believe it's a shame that it took this long into the administration for it to happen. But now that it's happened, this is really good. And I think they deserve a lot of credit for getting it right.
I do. I agree with you. And notice that these are GS-15s. These are the people who presumably will be on the short list, become members of the SES. Mm-hmm. So they will be taking this background, this experience, this knowledge, this confidence that they can really collaboratively address cross-agency problems with them into a new SES position. So I think it's a very good program, and as you suggest, long overdue, but we got it now.
The cross-agency part of this, I think, is probably the most important thing.
It is.
To get people out of stovepipes and to get them into other buildings and other organizations and see fresh faces and fresh ways of doing business. And I think potentially the most important benefit is not what that person has to offer to the agency that they go to. It's what they can take back to the agency they came from. I imagine most of these folks, if they leave from the Department of A, they're going to go back to the Department of a year from now after they've concluded this program, and they're going to have so much more to offer just from a spectrum point of view than they ever would have.
I agree. And at root, this program is very much different from things that have been tried in the past. In the past, there have been programs that expose groups of people to different problems, different issues, across government. But in this program, these folks are actually going to be assigned real cross-agency problems and expected to come up with real solutions, which is a much different approach than has been taken in the past. So it's not only an intellectual effort, it's an applied effort as well.
I'm looking down the list in this piece, and there are a couple of these folks that I know. The first name that jumped out at me is Jim Gilani from the General Services Administration, who has done terrific work at the Federal Acquisition Service there. But there, this is a very distinguished list of people. It comes from a terrific cross-section of agencies. Just about every major agency and some of the smaller agencies are represented here. What has to happen, do you think, in the course structure, in the educational structure here, to make sure that a year from now these people do have the skills and have enhanced the abilities that they bring in naturally to take back to their agencies and maximize the benefit?
The emphasis has to be on personal leadership development. This is not about being a subject matter expert. Rather, it's about developing my skills as a leader to create a collaborative environment where new solutions emerge. And that requires my own personal development together with acquiring the ability to use a problem-solving process that will engage people to solve those cross-agency problems. Because right now, when a cross-agency problem is assigned, representatives are selected and they go and they say, my boss says A, and the other one says, my boss says B, and my boss says C. And, you know, so they meet for a few months and then go back home and nothing has happened.
Mm-hmm.
With this program, my boss says A, my boss says B, my boss says C. Now, what would D look like?
Mm-hmm. The thing that I think is potentially most powerful about that concept too, Bob, is in a group like this, where there's a diversity of agencies and a diversity of people with backgrounds, that's the easiest thing to find common ground, I would think. I'm not suggesting it's easy, but it's the easiest. For example, I'm just pulling two names at random off the list. Somebody from GSA who goes into the Internal Revenue Service to solve some kind of a problem is going to most likely be able to apply those leadership skills to whatever he or she goes back to GSA and works with, rather than the nuts and bolts problem that he or she was working on inside IRS. Is that a fair assumption and statement?
Exactly right. I'm going to take back two things. One, I'm going to take back my own personal development, so I'm going to be better in relation to my colleagues, my boss, and those I lead. But number two, I'm going to have learned a process that I can apply for solving problems across my own agency, which often are as stovepiped as agencies are against each other.
Well, that's the next place that I wanted to go, is that we talk about agency-to-agency stovepipes and the importance of the cross-agency piece of it. But, for example, there are a couple of folks on this list that I saw from DHS, one at Citizenship and Immigration Services. There is another from the Office of Selective Acquisitions. I imagine those two organizations, one at DHS HQ and one at the Component, probably don't have a whole lot of collaboration going on right now within one organization.
My bet is when they meet each other for the orientation of this group, they will say, do we live on the same planet or not?
There'll probably be a lot of that going on. The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Bob Tobias. It's from GovExec. White House announces inaugural participants in program to develop new federal leaders. And you can find that and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week as I've selected it on this week's Federal News Countdown. Back on In Depth with Francis Rose, this week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by me and by Bob Tobias. And Bob, my choice at number one is my colleague Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com. Agencies warned to begin improving IT reform efforts. The first federal report card, Jason writes, on the Federal IT Acquisition Reform Act shouldn't be considered a scarlet letter for the majority of agencies that didn't do well. And the majority of agencies didn't do well. The average grade was a D, which on any report card is not great. You as an educator know that all too well. What I think is important here is not the technology part. What I think is important, and the reason that I chose this, knowing that you were coming on, is the management part, because I see and am starting to detect in the way that especially CIOs are talking about this and some of the other positions too, a very minute shift, and I'm curious for your thoughts on this. Rather than thinking about him or herself as a chief information officer, CIOs seem to be understanding that they now need to think about themselves as the CEO of an IT organization, and they expect to interact with the chief human capital officer, not as a Chico, but as the CEO of the human capital operation, and the CEO of the financial management operation, and the CEO of the acquisition operation. And it becomes almost like a council of CEOs rather than the CXO councils that we've talked about before. I don't know if that makes a big difference in the way that those people communicate with each other, but it seems to me that it would have to make some difference.
I think it makes a huge difference. I think how I see myself in the world, how I see myself in relation to my colleagues, makes a huge difference on whether or not I can successfully work with them to solve my problem, and recognizes that I might need them to help me solve my problem. I cannot solve all the problems I have leading an IT shop alone. I need others from other parts of the agency to help me do better.
Well, I will take that and raise it a little bit. And in the way that I mean that is, I would suggest that maybe they're starting to see that they don't have my problem anymore. We have our problems. And how do we collaborate together if the agency is not able to recruit the kind of people that we need to perpetuate the mission of the agency? Then as the chief information officer, that is not just the Chico's problem anymore. That's my problem too, because one piece of that is, are we getting the IT infrastructure people that we need to be able to succeed? And the CFO says, are we getting the financial management professionals that we need to be able to perpetuate and support the mission of the agency effectively? And so all of these problems don't belong to one person anymore or belong to one part of the organization anymore. They belong to the entire organization.
I think that's right. And I guess more importantly, or equally of equal importance, if I'm the head of the IT, I could go to my office and talk to all of my colleagues in the IT program and say, those people over there in HR, they never give me what I need. They never give it to me on time. And when I interview people, they don't get them on job and they don't do this, they don't do that, they do something else, which is all about blame and not about taking responsibility and accountability for the fact that I need who I need and I need to have the HR folks work with me to provide me what I need, that blaming them for not providing me will not get the job done.
Did a conversation recently that was hosted by Learning Tree International, and I had a panel with Mike Casey, who's the chief learning officer at GSA, and Richard McKinney, the CIO at the Transportation Department, and Richard Spires, who's now at Learning Tree and was the chief information officer at Homeland Security and at the Internal Revenue Service, all on the panel. And those three guys, at least, get it when it comes to the collaborative piece. And one of the things that Richard said was, we've kind of been doing some of this stuff already. Now, his grade didn't come out so hot, but he has kind of been setting expectations, I think just as importantly within his organization as outside the organization, like Congress facing, that this is an iterative process. We're beginning this, and this is not going to necessarily start out well. How it starts out isn't nearly as important as how it ends up. And as that conversation developed, that's posted on federalnewsradio.com, by the way, as that conversation developed and that thought process developed, it occurs to me that that's the right focus. We did see some of that in the Oversight and Government Reform Committee this week, thinking about how this gets us to the end point, which is better delivery of all of these processes to support the mission of the agencies, rather than you stink right now and we're going to beat you over the head because of that.
Well, yes, I do stink right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so
figuratively, not literally, fortunately.
Thank you. So the issue is, now that I have this data, do I deny it? Do I blame somebody else? Or do I accept responsibility and figure out a collaborative solution to the problem? It would stun me if these grades were A's. And I would challenge the rating system if they were A's.
Mm-hmm.
They are D's. So be it. They are D's. So what am I going to do about it now to increase those grades strategically?
Mm-hmm.
And I think your point is an important one. Oftentimes, we forget that when we're asking people to change their behavior quite significantly, which is what this is all about, people don't change their behavior in a week or a month. It's whether or not we as a group have the discipline, the sustained discipline over time to support the behavior change we seek. And if we don't have that, those grades are going to stay at D. If we get impatient, they're going to stay at D.
Mm-hmm.
If we don't supplement what we learn with increased training and development, they're going to stay at D. So if I have a sustained discipline approach, the grades will increase.
We just have a minute or so left, but you hit on exactly what I had scribbled down here. I had scribbled down change management as the most important component here, and you narrowed that, I think, very effectively with that phrase behavioral change. The getting that right consists of what are the one, two, or three most important elements as we wrap up, Bob?
Identifying the change you seek in the future, identifying the existing behavior, and supporting people as they struggle to change.
My most important federal news story of the week is from federalnewsradio.com. Agencies warned to begin improving IT reform efforts. Jason Miller has it on federalnewsradio.com. And that and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown are archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We'll put the audio from the program up there later this afternoon so you can listen to it as well. Terrific to see you, my friend. Thanks for coming in. It is always great to have you on the program, regardless of how you're here, Bob.
Thanks for having me. It's always a great deal of fun.